My guest today, Dr. Hatem Basian, is a co-founder, member of the Board of Trustees and faculty at Zaytuna College in Berkeley. He also serves as chair of the Northern California Islamic Council and is co-founder and chair of American Muslims for Palestine. Dr. Basian received his PhD in philosophy and Islamic studies from the University of California, Berkeley, where he currently is a senior lecturer in the departments of Near Eastern and Ethnic Studies. And he teaches a course on Islamic law and society, Islam in America, deconstructing Islamophobia, and othering of Islam, religious studies, and Middle Eastern studies. Between 2002 and 2007, he served as an adjunct professor of law at Bolt School of Law at UC Berkeley, and he is a visiting professor at religious studies at St. Mary's College and advisor to the Religion, Politics, and Globalization Center at UC Berkeley. Recently, he was named in the category for social justice as one of the Muslim 500, the world's most influential Muslims, by the Royal Islamic Strategic Studies Center. I should also add that while at UC Graduate School pursuing his doctorate, he was one of the most active leaders in the campus anti-apartheid movement. Welcome again, Dr. Hatem Basian, to Takes on the World.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for having me.
Get you up a little bit here. This morning, before I went on the air, there was a message, an alert, that the Palestine Authority and Hamas had agreed to a new unity government, and I wanted to start the program with your take on that.
I would say it's still too early to make any conclusions about it, of what are the possibility of a unity government.
There
will be many parties that will attempt to once again disrupt Palestinian unity and attempt to reconcile the differences. And I think here Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and Israel will try as much as possible to continue to disrupt the possibility of forming a unity government. And the pressure will be placed on the participants to have a unity government that will be more reflective of the desires of the major players at the expense of the Palestinians. So I would still hold my breath until I see something that is really meaningful and represents the hopes and aspirations of the Palestinians.
Well, we get different messages from the Palestinian Authority. Just yesterday, Mahmoud Abbas's meeting with two representatives of the Israeli Labor and Meretz Party, in which he promised no matter what happens to the peace talks, quote-unquote peace talks, peace process, quote-unquote, that the Palestinian Authority's collaboration with the Israeli Defense Forces in suppressing resistance to occupation in the West Bank will continue. That seems to be something that Hamas could not possibly agree to.
Well, I think, once again, when we think of the Palestinian-Israeli peace process, and in here the peace process is a metaphorical name, not a real name, the only area that has actually been implemented is in terms of the security coordination and collaboration at the expense of the Palestinians' ability to resist and challenge the occupation. And therefore, I am not surprised nor shocked at the continuation of this collaboration that has taken place and continued coordination of security to suppress Palestinians, especially right now in the West Bank, where activists are pursued, arrested, placed in prison, tortured, with the knowledge and, if anything, rather the consent of all the participants, including the Palestinian Authority, the Israeli Security Services, the American military trainers on the ground in the West Bank, as well as the Jordanian trainers, all having the focal point of snuffing out Palestinian resistance to the occupation and pushing forward a peace plan that maintains occupation by other means, which means that the Palestinian Authority would rule over the Palestinian civilian population, but all other elements are maintained in the hands of Israel. So it's an occupation by means of a peace process, and I recently said that Israel have really utilize the peace process to create a facts on the ground and maintaining occupation by means of negotiations. So the negotiations essentially have created the structures to maintain the Israeli control over the occupied territories for the foreseeable future, and at the same time moving massive numbers of settlers and building settlements from 1993 until now, that the number of settlers in the occupied territories have almost tripled over the period of the peace process. So in essence, Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority are really speaking of a matter of fact of what they will continue to undertake in relations to Israel. Furthermore, the financing and the funding that is directed from the U.S. and the European Union passes through Israel, and it's conditional upon maintaining and expanding the security coordination. And that's why, and also another element, that both the European Union and the, more so also the United States have been participant in maintaining and expanding Israel's occupational infrastructure over the Palestinians and been enablers of it for whatever passes as the international community. If anything, the international community has been part and parcel of the structure of the occupation over the Palestinians, and any type of criticism that they usher toward Israel is a criticism that tucked at the last paragraphs of whatever statement that they declared with expressing considerable allegiance and support for Israel's ability to continue to be in formulating its status quo over the Palestinians.
Well, it gets so flagrant when Secretary of State Kerry brings in to help facilitate the negotiations two former, the former head of the AIPAC spawn Washington Institute of Near East Policy, an Israeli lobbyist from almost birth, and David Makovsky, who edited the Jerusalem Post for 10 years and is now the leading public spokesperson for the Washington Institute, as kind of neutral figures in this honest brokered deal. How many times can this be presented not just to the Palestinians but to the world without people saying, come on, this is a farce?
Well, that's the whole thing. Is the notion that the United States is an honest broker is an insult to basic intelligence. The United States is a broker, but the description and the characteristic of honest is definitely missing, if it's not completely an error in how the U.S. role has been articulated. As possibly your listeners know, the United States packages Israeli proposals and give them an American garb and then puts them at the table for the Palestinians to fulfill and be pressured to accept them. And the Israel lobby in Washington and many of its operatives, both in the State Department and in the circles of power in Washington, really have considerable role to play in formulating U.S. policy when it comes to the Israel-Palestine. And therefore, David Makowski and Martin Indig, Dennis Ross, and the whole host of personalities that are a revolving door from AIPAC to Near East Institute to State Department to various special envoys to the Palestine-Israel negotiations is an insult to basic intelligence. At the core of it is attempting to compel the Palestinians to accept their dispossession as the only way for them to have any resemblance of living in really in just tranquility in their own indigenous homeland. So whenever the United States sends another imagery to the region, I would say I counsel people not to have much hope. If anything, it's an attempt once again to pressure the Palestinians to accept the basic framework, which is maintaining occupation by other means. And increasingly, John Kerry, as well as many Europeans, and also participation of some Arab governments that are in bed with both the U.S. and Israel as it relates to the Palestinians are touting this economic development program, in essence, to create a golden cage to the Palestinians, offering them a golden economic opportunity as a substitute for real freedom, real independence, real state of their own, and an ending to occupation. So you see this new $4 billion development project that has been touted by John Kerry, and you have all kinds of investments that are being deployed to incentivize a creating of a Palestinian elite that accepts its dispossession by means of these incentives. And there are some circles within the Palestinian elite constituted around the Palestinian Authority and also having built bridges over economic opportunities with Jordan and other regional Arab countries, as well as the U.S. and Europe, are more than ready to sell their own quest for freedom for possible economic opportunity. And that's what is being facilitated right now. And this basic project, economic project, actually began by the Israeli government, by Netanyahu, by Peres and others who wanted to replace actual end of the occupation to bringing about economic development. And we see some of the key corporate entities that are using this as an avenue for them to possibly bring about a continuation of Israel dominance over the Palestinians. Just recently, you had Microsoft founder Bill Gates basically arguing or saying that as he began to invest in the Palestinian occupied territories, that this is the way to form a middle class, and this forming of middle class and improving standard of living will go a long way to solving and bringing an end to the Palestine-Israel conflict, meaning is purchasing Palestinian consent by means of economic opportunity. There is also many venture capitalists within Israel that are also linking up to some venture capitalists in the Palestinian territories. This is a new elite that is constituted around the Palestinian Authority in such a way to link economically Palestinians and Palestinian venture capitalists with Israeli venture capitalists without really addressing the fundamental issue of the occupation, the restrictions on freedom, the bypass roads, all of what is taking place and thinking only in terms of economics. And that's a very long-standing approach of using economic incentives and creating an elite connected economically as a way to bypass a real end to occupation and domination.
Well, it is so long-standing, as you pointed out in a recent article you wrote called The Peace Process and Constructing a New Cage for the Palestinians. It really goes back to Theodor Herzl. You begin an article with a long quote from his diaries, and in one of the phrases, the property owners will come over to our side. Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly, circumspectly. But we must expropriate the private property in the states assigned to us and spirit the penniless across the border. Well, this happened in 48. Some remained, of course. Palestinians remained. But still, there is that never-ending talk of the transfer of Palestinians to Jordan, which many right-wing Israelis say is already a Palestinian state. And so maybe you could speak to that.
Well, I think Theodor Herzl's quote is very important, and I would say it sounded foundational to the early development of Zionist planning and understanding. And if you also think of it as it, you could connect it to Vladimir Jabotinsky's writing on what it would require for the colonial project that would displace and expel the indigenous Palestinian population and to use the use of force against it, we begin to understand the dynamic of dispossessing the Palestinians, which is a project that is still underway today. Beginning, I would say, in the early 20s with the with the help of the British, facilitating this colonial project that really dispossessed the Palestinians and slowly begins to move them away from their indigenous land to the major expulsion that takes place during the Nakba in 1947-48, which, as you possibly know, Ilan Pape as well as others have demonstrated with their research from Israeli military archives and the Israeli government archives that this was a planned undertaking. It was not a spontaneous, nor was it a incidental. Rather, it was a planned, carried out with the highest levels of government involved in terms of Ben-Gurion and his kitchen cabinet to bring about the expulsion of the Palestinians in 48, and then 1967, the complete expansion into the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the Golan Heights, followed by a whole infrastructure of settlements activities taking place. At each juncture, the project did involve working with a number of Palestinian elites to incentivize them to see the Israeli and Zionist project as a benefit to them. And that's where Herzl says the land, the property owners will come to our side. And I would say this specific terminology can be seen to have been put in practice early on inside Palestine. It's also been put in practice in creating relations with Arab elites. And I bring in the article a comparison or at least an analysis of the Jordanian-Israeli peace process that hinged on creating a Jordanian economic elite that would push away or push aside the Palestinian economic power in Jordan, because historically Palestinians in Jordan had considerable leverage over the Jordanian economy, where Jordanian tribes and various parts of the structure held the military and key governmental posts. And therefore, the Israeli-Jordanian peace process was directed at weakening and severing Palestinian economic power and abilities in Jordan that would lead to encircling the Palestinians inside the occupied territories, and therefore they would not have an economic depth in relations to Jordan. The second economic elite, new elite, that is wedded to the economic power of Israel, and therefore it would begin to defend its own interests in Jordan and Israeli interests because they see their interests to be wedded. It's a strategy that has succeeded, and on top of that, also loading Jordan with tremendous amount of debt, equaling to about $26 to $27 billion, thus undermining in the foreseeable future Jordanians' independent decision-making ability. And one could argue whether Jordan have historically had independent decision-making ability. That's what you call an argument that could be entertained. But in essence, with the heavy debt that is financed by the United States, the IMF, and European powers, this makes the new Jordanian elite that was put into practice and put into force during this process being subservient to Israeli interests vis-a-vis the Palestinians. Furthermore, Jordan have began to serve as the bridge to expand and facilitate Israel's penetration to other parts of the Arab Muslim world economy, and as such, this also creates other opportunities for Israel economic links to Arab elites and Muslim elites in such a way that Israel interest becomes wedded to specific elites in many parts of the Arab and Muslim world. And that's why the strategy of the property owners coming to our side, it's a strategy that has been worked deliberately, systematically, and so far as it relates to the Palestinian Authority inside the occupied territories, as it relates to Jordan, and one can add also as it relates to Egypt, as we see the dynamics that have unfolded in Egypt through the Arab Spring, one has to recognize that a key component of the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty under the Camp David is also has a part of it that relates to the creation of the economic elite. let me speak in here about the U.S. role in this. The United States International Aid and Development have also, as it extended the foreign aid, have made one of these conditions is to link Israeli economy to the peace process in these in the countries that have engaged in relations with Israel in such a way that the U.S. incentivizes with the resources. And as such, the U.S. have acted as a key ingredient of pushing ahead with this type of economic plan and also granting these countries that accept this particular type of a structure to have most favorable nation relations with the U.S. as it relates to the economy and entry of their products into the United States. So as such, both the Jordanian-Egyptian economy, one could also include Indonesia, Mauritania, and some of the other sub-Saharan countries have been granted most favorable nation clause as it relates to economic relations, and as such, weakening their ability to exert any type of pressure or influence vis-a-vis the Palestinians and to try to possibly put pressure to end the occupation. And that's the dynamic that we're seeing that dates back to Herzl's own ideas, but is continued as part and parcel of the strategy of how to actually isolate the Palestinians and remove the layers of support, whether it's in the Arab or Muslim world or also broadly in many parts of the world. And that's the, at least the consequences and the crisis that we're facing on a constant basis in dealing with the particularities of the Palestinians.
And that makes, of course, the U.S. attitude toward other Arab countries dependent on how their relationship is with Israel.
Oh, absolutely. I think the one major criteria as it relates to U.S. relations with the Arab and Muslim world is that one of these items is how open they are to Israel, whether it's being diplomatic relations, whether it's being economic relations. And now I think the economic relations are taking precedent over the political relations. So you can actually have some states who don't have political diplomatic relations with Israel, but nevertheless they have economic relations facilitated through a variety of structures in a globalized economy, facilitating the extension and the expansion of Israel's economic leverage and power in both the region as well as globally. And that's, I think, one of those items that we have to continue to observe and understand as it relates to the global movement for BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction. As the grassroots movement is taking hold, what we see is that Israel's strategy is likewise is working at a state level and at a macroeconomic processes with the United States and the European Union institutionally making it possible for Israel to bypass and sometimes challenge the grassroots movement that is emerging calling for the boycott, divestment, and sanction. And that is unfortunate, but we need to be aware of those dynamics to be able to challenge it, alter it, and bring about a different approach to how really we challenge the basic structures that have been put in practice by Israel and the United States.
Well, Dr. Bazian, I want to it seems to be clear that Israel, under the circumstances, has no interest in signing any kind of agreement with the Palestinians because everything seems to be going their way.
Well, I really can't see with the current cast of characters in the Israeli government and also the, how the region looks like, I cannot see that Israel feels compelled or seeing itself to have any incentive from its own perspective to sign a deal. Just think of the current status of the region. The Palestinian Authority, with all intensive purposes, are an employee of the Israeli security apparatus. They fulfill all of Israel needs inside the occupied territories. Economically, they have accepted to be almost a middleman in extending and enabling Israel's economy to penetrate furthermore the Palestinians and become further hostages to Israel's economic underpinning. As far as the regional picture, it looks at this point very dismal. Egypt is in a very chaotic state, but both the current leadership in Egypt that emerged as a result of the coup is committed to Israel's security and to possibly putting pressure on the Palestinians, in particular putting pressure on Palestinians to accept the diktats of Israel. And the coordination at the Gaza-Egypt border is at the highest level in such a way to disrupt any possibility of a counter-pressure from emerging. Similarly, Syria is in a major chaos with a civil war that's going on 3 years. And I think both Iran and Hezbollah are in committed to that fight, and thus the containment strategy to bring Iran and Hezbollah into Syria have succeeded. And there's a preoccupation of all the resources being directed there. The Gulf states are committed right now to confronting Iran and using Syria as the avenue and the strategy for that containment to be unfold. The European Union, likewise, I don't see any initiative. They're all preoccupied with the outcomes of the Arab Spring, whether it's in Syria, Egypt, and other places. They're facing economic difficulties as a result of the economic collapse, and also they are deferring to the United States in this sense. So I really can't see any pressure point that is open at this particular time to make Israel wanting to make to sign any type of a peace deal with the Palestinians. And possibly that is the hubris that Israel had, because they are in a powerful position, and, you know, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, that Israel's absolute power over the Palestinians make them not actually wanting to alter that relationship, because they think they could project it to the foreseeable future. And that's basically what I say, the stupidity of power, that when you have it, you think that you're invincible. And Israel today, as it relates to the Palestinians and the broader Arab world, and you could extend it to the Muslim world, it sees itself as strategically invincible, but I think that is a deluded stand for them to take at this particular time, and they have no possibility of actually emerging from a strategic box that they have placed themselves as it relates to the Palestinians inside the occupied territories.
Well, given the dismal present and the absence in this country, of even though the BDS movement is growing, the distance between where it has to reach to be effective and what the needs are in Palestine on the ground, the prospects are not bright. And then, of course, given the power the Israel lobby has over the U.S. political process, in which to counter it is to challenge your career, your career choices. What can be done, or is what are the likelihood of something else happening, something to add to the equation which will change this, or is this the situation for the foreseeable future?
Well, I'm very pessimistic in the short run. I think in the long run, I'm very optimistic in terms of what are the possibilities and likelihood. I think there is a strong grassroots movement that is emerging in the U.S., in Europe, in Latin America, in Africa, and parts of Asia, that I would say in the long run, it will make a difference. Domestically, I think we have to assess that there is a growing gulf that is emerging between what is the power of AIPAC that functions very well inside the belt in Washington and its surroundings versus what might take place across the country. Increasingly, also college campuses are showing a very decisive move away from being only sympathetic to Israel to actually being more sympathetic to the Palestinian perspective, with victories of PDS resolutions being passed at various student councils and student government councils across the country. And I think that demonstrates that there is a grass movement that is emerging, that is beginning to influence the consciousness on college campuses, and also begins to make an impact among variety of communities affiliated with it. Similarly, I would say the progressive segment of the religious communities, the Presbyterians, the Unitarians, even to the level of the Anglicans, are having consideration of resolutions of boycott, of divestment, and sanctions that likewise is beginning to register. The academic institutions with the Asian American Studies Association, the Native American Studies Association, even having a number of the American Studies Association as well, and panels in almost every academic institution discussing the standing of the Palestine-Israel conflict, shows that there is a considerable unease among the intellectual class and among also the activist class within the United States. Now, the next level of how to transform that into a meaningful strategy that begins to challenge the power of AIPAC as it relates to the electoral process. And I think that's where the long-haul strategy development and consideration has to be vested. But I'm very optimistic that in the long run that will make a difference as well, because I think the unanimity and the single direction of U.S. foreign policy as it relates to Palestine being dictated and developed by AIPAC, I think it will be coming to an end in a shorter period rather than a longer period. And I think all these developments point to this likelihood. Lastly, I would say that also the Arab and Muslim community broadly within the United States is beginning to come out of the post 9/11 fear and blanket of almost being sidelined from engaging in a very progressive as well as engaged process is being to show some effect in various parts of the country. And I'm very optimistic that that period of the new generation that has emerged in post 9/11 will begin to demonstrate and put into effect some of its own engagements. And I think Palestine will be one of those issues that will be at their agenda at the end, at the table moving forward. So while in short period it is a pessimistic view, I would say in the long run, change is coming, and I would begin to link to many of these activities that are taking place across the country.
Well, as a former anti-apartheid activist at UC Berkeley, one of the things I want to get your point of view. One of the differences I've seen is that if a member of Congress at that point supported apartheid in South Africa, that would have finished them politically. But when it comes to Israel, some left activists, liberal activists will say, well, you can't have this politician good on every issue. And then when I ask them, what if that politician supported apartheid in South Africa, they're silent.
Well, you remember that early on, the support for South Africa was present among the halls of Congress. If you remember, Reagan in the early 80s had this strategy of constructive engagement. And basically, I would say, I compare it to the current strategy of investing in the Palestinian territories as a way of trying to improve the standard of living of the Palestinians. So a similar strategy in the early 80s and late 70s was pursued by a certain segment of the political elite in this country. And I think we are at this juncture, at this point, of individuals that are still beholden to maintaining support for Israel. And I think part of this is the presence of a very strong, engaged, well-organized, pro-Israel Jewish community that is committed to this. But I would say it's not uniform, nor it is represents the full spectrum. I think there's many Jewish Americans, including yourself, Jewish Voice for Peace, and others, that are beginning to engage with a very profound critique to what is taking place. I think what we need is how to develop an electoral strategy to complement the grassroots strategy. And so far, that has not developed. And I think that's where I would say our creativity, our focus, our strategy has to be developed in such a way that we would put an electoral strategy within the United States that would begin to actually strategize toward those congressmen and those senators and those local political leadership that sees the 11th commandment of thou shalt support Israel, right or wrong, to be challenged and to be challenged systematic. And I think that's where I would say our next period of organizing have to dedicate considerable time and resources and effort to bring about that change. And I am myself optimistic that will happen.
Well, this is something I know. Personally, I've been working on that side of the issue for years, and it's been very frustrating to run into people who simply have decided or agreed with Noam Chomsky that the Congress is unimportant. The reason the U.S. supports Israel, that Israel is an asset for the United States, and that Congress just goes along with it, and the lobby is going through an open door, so to speak, and the lobby is not important. Maybe in a couple of minutes we have
No, the lobby is very important. We wouldn't say that the NRA is unimportant, the American exactly. Medical Association is unimportant. Everyone will immediately recognize that our NRA and our policy to try to bring about any limitation on this is influenced by the impact of the NRA or American Medical Association, or even in the positive, the National Association of Retired Americans also plays a role in policies domestically. So the role of the of AIPAC cannot be overstated. Rather, it does have and play a major role in shaping and directing U.S. policy. Its work within the halls of Congress is very well established. It doesn't mean that it's invincible, but it requires for us to recognize its impact, where it moves its resources, and how it functions to influence U.S. Political decision-making when it comes to the Israel-Palestine, and sometimes also in other places where Israel interest is at hand and in concern. Now, there are often this attempt to try to say it's either-or. It's not either that you are committed to say that AIPAC determines the outcome, or is it U.S. imperialism that determines the outcome, and therefore it's either-or. No, we have a partnership in here that is working in hand in hand to strategize for projecting a particular notion of U.S. power around the world, that Israel is at the hub of that power and that relation. And AIPAC has been able to weave its own articulation of how to support Israel into that strategy. And as such, we need to challenge those congressmen and senators that continue to project that as part and parcel of U.S. strategic interest, where sometimes that strategic interest actually departs or is divergent. And you could actually both critique U.S. strategic national interest as well as critique AIPAC without having to actually only constantly say it's only U.S. strategic interest that is at work, and dispense with critiquing AIPAC. And I think that's the problem, where individuals will hold themselves only on one perspective and project it as being the only way to view the relationship. And I think that's where the Chomsky's perspective and those who take his perspective have to be at least challenged as in terms of the singular approach to how we evaluate U.S.-Israel strategic
and
relations and dispensing with AIPAC.
Thank you so much, Hatem. At that point, we have to end. Dr. Hatem Bazian, my guest today, thank you for an incredible interview.